I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. We're all waiting for the top kill, BP's Plan B to stop the well oil gushing into the Gulf by pouring mud and then cement over the well. Meanwhile, there are hearings today in Louisiana and Washington. A congressional memo released last night claims an internal BP investigation indicates that warning signs at the rig were ignored, a crucial mistake made 2 hours before the explosions. BP's CEO said today at least seven serious failures were made. In Washington, Interior Secretary Ken Salazar is defending offshore drilling, but also proposing enhanced inspections in future drilling, a plan President Obama is expected to outline tomorrow before traveling to the Gulf on Friday. Stephen Powers is with the Wall Street Journal. He's monitoring all these hearings. And Stephen, as we wait for the top kill, what are we learning today?
Sure. In Louisiana, you've got hearings that are going on today, presided over by the Coast Guard, in which a worker from the rig who was a survivor of this accident claims to have overheard some of his superiors talking about having to take shortcuts to finish the well more quickly than they thought was advisable. Then separately in Washington, various congressional committees are looking into the spill themselves, and late yesterday, one of those committees produced a memo that was written off of a briefing that BP gave to members of Congress and their staffs yesterday, in which BP discusses potentially a fundamental mistake being made 2 hours before the fatal blast, in which workers essentially may have missed signs of an abnormality in the pressure readings from a pipe.
Yeah. Well, and in addition to these ongoing hearings, which seem to be getting closer and closer to figuring out exactly what happened on April 20th, there have been town hall meetings across the Gulf this week. Let's listen to Erwin Meneses. He's a commercial fisherman at a civic center in Louisiana.
I'm not seeing BP coming to help me save my heritage yet. That's important to me, just as important as any money. You're not going to replace me being able to teach my kid how to fish. How can you replace that?
Stephen, tell us a little more about what people are saying. And we heard this morning a BP CEO apologize for making the comment he made last week as oil was gushing still out of this well that he thought it was going to have, you know, modest environmental impact. He's apologized. But what's the sense of, you know, the outrage?
Yeah, well, the Obama administration is clearly very frustrated with BP. And they're frustrated also because they know that members of Congress are leaning on them increasingly to solve this problem. The predicament that they're in is that the government does not really have the technical expertise to fix this problem, this well that's leaking 5,000 feet beneath the surface. The government doesn't have the equipment and really is not able to fix it directly, so they're having to rely heavily on BP. Now, some have suggested, well, maybe the government could contract with another company to come in and try to fix it, another company that has as much experience in deep water. But that Allen, the Coast Guard commandant, ruled that out this week. He said that would not make much sense because BP still has more knowledge about the site itself, and that bringing in another company would potentially risk involving someone who just doesn't know the site very well. So the government's in a very tricky position. They're also in a tricky position because legally, if they assume responsibility for fixing the leak, the government's also going to be assuming the liability. So it's a very difficult position for the administration.
Well, also testifying today in Washington, the head of the Minerals Management Service, which is supposed to have regulated the oil industry, but we've had scathing reports alleging that drilling regulators were too close to the industry, accepted hunting and fishing trips, were negotiating jobs with oil companies while simultaneously inspecting the rigs. And then also testifying Interior Secretary Ken Salazar, who had pledged to clean up MMS and, of course, isn't making any changes until, you know, after this disaster. He's also reiterating his support for offshore drilling today with enhanced inspections of rigs. Do we know any more about what the Obama administration is proposing on that front?
No, they have not yet announced their plans. I suspect that to some extent it will draw on certain ideas that the oil and gas industry themselves are coming up with, because the oil and gas industry recognizes that there's a regulatory freight train coming down the track and they want to get ahead of that. I think it's likely that you're going to see tougher regulation of blowout preventers. These are sort of like the last line of defense on these rigs, and that's something that Mr. Salazar has already said he thought the regulation was too lax on. So I think that that's one area in particular.
Stephen Power with the Wall Street Journal. Stephen, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Okay, a question today. Can you roll back time? Literally, can you reduce the effects of aging? Renowned Harvard psychologist Ellen Langer says, yes, if you pay attention, if you're mindful.
Unforgettable. That's what you are.
In 1979, Ellen Langer took two groups of elderly men on a retreat to a hotel that was completely reconfigured to look and feel like the 1959 of their heyday. Nat King Cole on the stereo, Ed Sullivan on the TV. One group was told to act as if it really was 1959. The other was told to act as if it was the present, but in a 1959 setting. Now, both groups had some good effects, but one, well, we'll find out. It became known as the counterclockwise study, which is also the title of Ellen Langer's new book, Counterclockwise: Mindful Health and the Power of Possibility. It's also the topic of a proposed film in which Jennifer Aniston is slated to portray Dr. Langer doing her early work. So what is mindfulness? And did that trip down memory lane make these men younger? We want to spend a few minutes today with Professor Ellen Langer, who joins us in the studio. Welcome.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
First, tell us a little about the study. Who were the participants?
It was amazing, Robin. As they came in, usually with their adult daughter, they looked as if they weren't going to make it down the hall. That's how decrepit and old they seemed. With the first person who came in, I said to myself, why am I doing this? You know, I was going to be taking on something that potentially was very large.
And why were you doing it? You wanted to find out what?
Well, we had this idea that although philosophers and psychologists for forever had separated the mind and the body, that for most people, you are just a single person. And if we took the mind and the body, we put it back together, then it would seem wherever we're putting the mind, we're also putting the body. So what we started was a series of studies that we've continued to today, where we put the mind in healthy places and take our measurements from the body.
So that brings us back to these elderly people, these men that you say looked decrepit when they first came to you. You bring them up to New Hampshire where you've created a place where they are living in 1959.
What was interesting, I think, is that the first group that we brought there was the control group. These were the people who were reminiscing. So they were always aware that everything that they were going to be talking about and experiencing was the past. But they were in the present, that was the past. Okay, so as the van that we're on is getting closer to the retreat, I realize there are eight men and eight large suitcases and me. And there was no way that I was going to carry each of these suitcases up to their rooms. So I decided to tell them it was their responsibility. They could move their suitcases an inch at a time, closer and closer to the room they'd be staying in. They could unpack it there and take a shirt at a time. Well, this was so different from the way they had been treated prior to this that even for this group that was the control group, the group where we weren't really expecting much to happen, there were big changes.
You're saying that by giving them the responsibility,
right,
it what, changed them?
Yes. Well, not just giving them the responsibility, but all of a sudden treating them again like they're full people rather than over-caring for them and presuming that they're incompetent.
What happened with the group that was living in 1959?
They were supposed to speak about the past in the present tense. What was amazing to me was that in a very short while, well before the week was over, almost soon after it had just begun, you could feel the difference. These people seemed to come alive, figuratively, and then the measures that we subsequently took suggested that almost literally, you know, lots of their symptoms diminished, their eyesight improved, their hearing improved. We had taken photographs of all of them, both groups, prior to going to the retreat and then at the end of this, and we showed the photographs to people who were not aware of what the study was about, and these people were rated as looking younger.
So what do you take from this, especially given your field, which is this idea of mindfulness instead of mindlessness? Apply it to what you learned there, because we should add, the people in the control group who only talked about 1959 as if it was in the past didn't have this cocoon effect, you know, didn't get younger. So apply mindfulness to that.
Well, I think that basically, we start off thinking that there are limits to what we can do, how we can be throughout our lives. And it becomes especially prevalent as we get older. we've taken to be true things like our memory must get worse, we must get weaker, our vision must decrease, and so on. And we just accept that mindlessly. And so then we live our lives making it true, essentially. And so by stepping back in time, we sort of get rid of those mindsets and people can flourish.
Except these men in your study, they weren't being mindful as much as they were making believe.
I don't think they were making believe. I think that by allowing themselves to be in the past allowed them to then be in the present in a different way. You know, to be a competent person rather than an old person.
But what you're taking from it is, if you try to change that environment that signals you are old, you will not be as old?
Yes. Let's bring it closer to the present. We've just done some other studies on this mind-body idea. So most of us have the assumption that we can see whatever the, you know, eye charts have told us is our limit in seeing. And that as you get older, again, vision only gets worse. And if you go to the doctor and you look at a typical eye chart, the eye chart goes from large letters to progressively smaller and smaller letters. Now, what that does implicitly is tell you soon you're not going to be able to see. So what we did was very simple. We reversed the eye chart. So now implicitly, because the letters are getting larger and larger, it says soon you will be able to see. And what we find was people can see now see what they couldn't see before.
Well, what do you say to people who say, well, wait a second, my eyesight is failing and it's not my fault? You see, okay, you're making it sound like it's their fault if they don't sort of change their thinking about it.
No, it's not our fault because we've been taught by the culture to expect all sorts of negative change. Once we believe we have some deficit, we stop trying to improve. We don't pay attention to the times that we don't have the deficit. So, for example, let's take dyslexia. So here we have people who transpose letters and numbers. Now, if you gave a dyslexic a page to read with, let's say, 250 words on it, my guess is that they would probably only misread two or three words, which means that more than 90% is being read correctly. It seems odd to me that we only attend to the deficit. Let's take somebody with asthma. They reach for the inhaler when they have trouble breathing. The medical world unintentionally teaches us to hold things still. So the inhaler is not calibrated. The inhaler says every time you need it, you need exactly the same amount. Well, it's never the case that you need exactly the same of anything. I have asthma, and I find, gee, when I'm with you, Robin, I don't need the inhaler. But when I'm with Susie, I need it. Well, if I was aware of that, if I paid attention to when I need it, when I don't, then it gives rise to the question, why? And it would lead me then to say, well, maybe I should stop seeing this other person or have interactions with that other person that are more like mine with you. There are ways I can control it.
Not making believe you don't have asthma, but noticing when it's better. That's psychologist Ellen Langer, thought-provoking, and we'll have more with her in 1 minute, here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
Welcome back. We're speaking with Harvard psychologist Ellen Langer. Her 1989 book, Mindfulness, was an international bestseller. Her new book is Counterclockwise, Mindful Health and the Power of Possibility. And Professor Langer, I just want to underscore, before the break, you were making the point that as a person with asthma, you pay attention to when you don't need your inhaler so you can spend more time in that space. But if someone is told, you know, never mind, you don't have any control over a chronic disease like asthma, then they won't try to have any control?
It's interesting because science, whether it's medical science, psychology, any science, cannot prove uncontrollability. All you can prove is that you can control something or we don't know. So if you knew that you had a disorder where we don't know, you might take steps to try to help yourself. If you had a disorder where you're told no matter what you do, you can't do anything about it, then you don't pay any attention to it.
Well, but here's where some of your critics say.
Ah, there are critics.
Don't
oh, my
imagine
goodness.
That. that sometimes it seems to move a little into New Age thinking. You're quoted saying, there is not good or bad. What's good or bad are the views we take of things.
And that goes back to Epictetus. I wasn't the first to say that. Echoed by Shakespeare.
But there are some people who would say, but there is bad.
No, there is bad. No, there is no good or bad. That's in your head. That's a construal.
My son has been killed in Iraq.
Okay. Let's say that there's no good or bad independent of context. So surely that there are, you know...
Take your time.
If you believe he died for his country and you're patriotic and that there's some larger good, then from that perspective... it can be seen as positive. Yeah. You know, but those aren't the experiences that most of us have every day. Most people who are stressed not because of these large things. They're usually small events where they believe that the event caused the stress. Chances are there are ways of packaging it so it looks quite different. And the reason that this is important is that right now, if you perceive something as bad, you have... no choice, almost, to mindlessly get away from it.
Accept your fate.
Right. And if you see something as good, well, then you have to have it. If you recognize it's neither good nor bad, then you're able to just sort of be. We end up with a lot more control once we recognize this rather than be pulled by external circumstances.
You said, and I'm paraphrasing here, that, for instance, when it comes to divorce, if children were taught that there's more than one sense of what makes a family, they would not feel as badly and wouldn't be as dramatically impacted by divorce.
Yeah.
And I read that and I thought, you know, I don't think children are devastated by divorce because they look around and they say, oh, my family doesn't match others. Isn't it possible that they're devastated because they miss a parent?
My position here might be a little radical. I think that if mommy and daddy were able to speak to Susie and Susie could feel, because it was real, that they were in a very good place and they were going to be happy, that would be the cue that Susie needs to be happy. But more often than not, this hostility, this fear, it's defining this thing as bad.
I want to talk about some other studies you point to. The hotel maid study?
This was a recent test of this mind-body idea. We put the mind and body back together. Then wherever we're putting the mind, we're putting the body. So we start with these chambermaids. Now, these people, although they exercise all day long, when we ask them how much exercise they get, they say they don't get any exercise.
Right.
Okay, well, so if exercise is so good for you, why is it that these women who are exercising all day long are less healthy than socioeconomic equivalent others? Part of the reason they don't see themselves as exercising is because exercise is defined for them, for the culture, by the Surgeon General who sits behind a desk all day.
Right.
And the only time there's exercise is after work. We take these chambermaids and we divide them into two groups and we simply teach one of the two groups that their work is exercise. We show them that making a bed is like working this and that machine at the gym and so on. So that this group is now persuaded that their work is exercise. So we go away, we come back. First thing we ask them, are they working any harder? No. Is she working any harder? No. Everything is the same. Are they eating any differently? No. And there was no difference except that these people now saw their work as exercise. Then we take the measures that matter. We found that they lost weight. There was a drop in blood pressure, a drop in waist-to-hip ratio and body mass index. And that, we say, was a function simply of the change in mindset.
Here's another one. This is a very famous study, the Xerox machine study. I love this. People are waiting on a Xerox machine. You had experimenters cut in line, and you told them to say specific things and then gauge the reaction.
This was one of the first mindlessness studies. You'd go up to somebody on a Xerox machine, and you'd say, excuse me, can I use a Xerox machine because I want to make copies? What else are you going to do with a Xerox machine?
But people said what?
They let you.
Well, what was the conclusion? Like, why did they do
that? Well,
that
because we have a script that if somebody makes a request and gives a reason, then unless it's outrageous, you comply. I mean, if I went over to you and I said, can I cut off your arm because I need an extra hand? Chances are you wouldn't let me.
Because I sort of might listen to that, but if you're standing on the Xerox line, you're being mindless. You're not really hearing what they said to you.
Right.
It's the form of the sentence.
Yeah, so I would argue and have now for, oh God, you know, over 30 years, that most people are mindless most of the time. And we're oblivious to it because when you're not there, you're not there to know you're not there. And so in study after study, we increase people's mindfulness and get improvements in almost everything, health and well-being, happiness, competence, creativity, memory. Mindfulness, as I study it, is the simple process of noticing new things. You just notice new things that puts you in the present, so it's easy and it's literally and figuratively enlivening.
Ellen Langer, professor of psychology at Harvard University. Her new book is Counterclockwise, Mindful Health and the Power of Possibility. Ellen, thanks so much. Professor Langer, thanks so much for talking to us.
Thank you for having me, Robin.
And by the way, we'll have an excerpt of Professor Langer's book at our website, hereandnow.org, where you can also weigh in, leave a comment, or send an email, hereandnow.org. Tomorrow on Here and Now, have we reached a tipping point in the Koreas? That is tomorrow. We'll have the very latest news next, Here and Now. In Afghanistan, preparations are underway for a national gathering, or Loya Jirga, which will bring some 1,500 delegates to the capital city, Kabul. If they drive through the city, the delegates are certain to come across the tens of thousands of children who work on the streets, trying to earn money to support their families. In a country torn by decades of war, many children have lost their fathers to violence or drugs, and as the BBC's Lise Doucette reports, their numbers are growing.
Imagine a little girl, just 10 years old, wearing pink shirt and trousers, picking her way through this sprawling hill of trash along the side of the street. It absolutely stinks. It's rubbish and food, bits of plastic, and Narges is picking through it, trying to take paper home for fires to heat the home, perhaps some bottles, bring in some money, anything of value here. She's lucky. It's just a life of luck lived on these streets and of survival.
I started work when I was six. I had to work to support my family so that my father and mother wouldn't starve. It is shameful for me to work, but I have to. If we had money, I wouldn't have to do this.
This is home. One room in a mud brick house on a cobble hill overlooking one of the richest neighborhoods. Four sisters, three brothers, a father who can't or won't work. He's a drug addict. That pains Narges's mother, and Narges knows that.
When I see my mother crying, I get upset, and so do my sisters. My mother says we should get him arrested, but even that wouldn't work. We gave him money to go to a hospital. He wouldn't go. He beats us and forces us to give him money.
Narges isn't the only one on the streets. Day and night, tens of thousands of children weave through these cars begging for money in a city targeted by suicide bombers and criminal gangs who traffic in people and drugs. In a country of 1.5 million drug addicts, a growing number are children, including 13-year-old Omid. His heavy eyes give him away. He admits it makes this hard life a little easier.
It makes me feel very light, like when you're drunk on alcohol. You feel as if you're a giant. You don't feel the weight on your shoulders.
The boys in the park, they say, Omid still does the drugs. Does that bother you?
When I see the other boys using drugs, part of me wants to join them, but then my heart tells me no.
Inside the classroom, these young children are now learning how to write sentences in Dari, sitting on a wooden desk, listening intently to these lessons. This center is called Ashiana. That means nest. This Afghan charity is a rare refuge for street children, including Narges, who eagerly sits in a crowded front row. Ashiana provides a few hours of school or a trade or just time to play. Something to give street children a better chance of one day getting off the streets. Engineer Yusuf is the director.
When they become adults, they will learn more from the street. They will not learn a lot of positive things when they are in the part of those kind of group. Now we're making environment for them to use their talent, and the better way they will become a good people.
Not far from Ashiana, on the same street as a recent suicide bombing, Mahfouz washes cars to support his family.
I've been working since I was 7. I'm not a scared little boy anymore.
In a country still at war, kids have to grow up fast. Like so many children, Mahfouz is the main breadwinner in his house. But how he wishes he wasn't. But boys will be boys. Mahfouz and Omid play in this park. Narguez walks across it, between classes and collecting trash. They're just kids. But kids grow up and shape this country's future.
The BBC's Lise Doucette in Kabul. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll take a look at that controversial mosque. It's proposed for just 2 blocks from New York's Ground Zero. That's in 30 seconds, here and now. A Lower Manhattan Community Board voted overwhelmingly last night in favor of giving a green light to building a Muslim community center just 2 blocks from Ground Zero. The center is backed by the nonprofit Cordoba Initiative. The vote capped off an emotional round of testimony. We want to hear both sides today. First, we're joined by Bob Townley with Community Board 1 in Lower Manhattan. And Bob, we know there were 10 abstentions from the full board, but among those who did vote, it was 29-1, including your yes vote. Now, this is just an advisory vote, not an official decision, but why are you in favor?
I guess because I've been a community organizer downtown for so long, and because I run a community center downtown, I understand the importance of bringing people together in dialogue. And while the media may have concentrated on the raucous nature of last night's meeting, I think God works in mysterious ways, and on some level there was a dialogue.
Well, and we want to hear what was said, but first let's explain to people. This proposed center is going to be as many as 15 stories high. It'll include a prayer space, a large performing arts center, a culinary school, a swimming pool. Will it be open to everyone in the community?
You know, I can't speak for the operators of this center. I assume it's open to everyone. I think for me, in my small vote last night, what I was saying is this is still America, and people of goodwill can go and do whatever they need to do, whether or not they're Christian, Muslim, Jews, or atheists.
Well, we know that there are people who've lost family members on 9/11 who do support the center, but what do you say to those who don't? They see this as a Tea Party activist, Mark Williams, calls it a monument to terror attacks. Well, they see it as a sort of a thorn in their side, something they have to be confronted with, something in their face.
Sure. And let me say that people that oppose the center are not only extremists. There was a child who I taught how to play football 20 years ago, who I taught how to take a hand off, and we were city champs, I may say, and he passed away in the Trade Center. And his mom spoke against this project. My good friend of 20 years introduced the resolution to table and not give support. So people of goodwill were on both sides. So I don't think that the fellow who's the Tea Partier fully represents the opposition.
Well, then what do you say to your good friends who are on the other side? How do you explain
the vote? I said it last night, that they were wrong, that we are hoping, and we have an optimistic bias, that by allowing dialogue, and as we push the Cordova Center to have dialogue, I believe they are wrong in withdrawing support. And I say this quite candidly. If this is the moderate Muslim community, the vast majority of Muslims, then we want to engage them because this is the only hope for peace in the long run. This is the dialogue and education, so they cannot take 18-year-old adolescents who are crazy or 20 Saudi Arabian maniacs. That this has to be addressed.
But couldn't that have been addressed through a community center not near Ground Zero?
I think what the people who are trying to build this community center, and there has been more than one mosque in Lower Manhattan, what they are trying to do is precisely make a statement against terrorism. They want to be in the mix on peace issues. They know what they're doing, and they're not doing it as a slap in the face of the family members, because if they are, they're going to hear from us. I was one of the first people on top of the pile at Ground Zero. When people ran one way, I ran to the pile. So we may be taking a gamble. I don't think so. And hopefully this will be a start reducing the sheer amount of people who are drawn to these idiotic ideologies.
Bob Townley with Community Board Number 1 in Lower Manhattan. Bob, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Well, let's turn now to Peter Gadiel. His 23-year-old son, James, was killed on the 103rd floor of the North Tower on 9/11. Peter Gadiel is a member of the 9/11 Families Foundation. He's opposed to the Muslim Community Center, two blocks from Ground Zero. Peter, your response to Bob, first of all.
Well, this man has just said he has a bias towards believing in the goodwill of the other side. He assumes, but he doesn't know, that the center will be open to the public. He is assuming the goodwill of the other side, yet the imam behind this said after 9/11 that the 9/11 attacks were a result of mistreatment of Muslims in the United States. He's assuming, but he doesn't know, that this will stop Muslims from recruiting 20-year-old maniacs. The fact is the history is all on the other side.
Well, Peter, you're obviously you have very strong feelings about this, but the people behind the mosque have said that they lost people on 9/11 as well, and feel that they have as much right to that land. And as you know, there are 9/11 family groups that support the proposed center.
I'm aware of that. But I do know that the main group that supports this 9/11 Families for Peaceful Tomorrows claims to have a membership of 200 9/11 family members. But I also know that it was founded by a couple of people who, 2 days after the 9/11 attacks, were already making political statements. All the families I know, 2 days after the attacks, were still worried about the whether they were going to find their loved ones. And these people are already out making political statements, and they're behind Peaceful Tomorrows.
What would it mean to you, having lost a son, to have a mosque or a community center in that space? Are you against mosques and community centers entirely?
I am against mosques and Muslim community centers that are funded from outside the country. If this is local money, if this is the community of Muslims living in our country, I think they should be free to do anything they want, like any Americans should, and they should be perfectly accepted as Americans. But I think a showing of goodwill would include not accepting money from the outside. We don't know the source of the funding for this.
And I guess to that point, when you go to Ground Zero, if this project goes forward and is built, it still has to go through an approval process. But if it's built and you go to Ground Zero, what do you anticipate that will mean to you?
It'll be offensive. It will be offensive. And if people make assumptions, naive assumptions like Mr. Townley, and read into the other side goodwill that may or may not be there, then it will be approved. But I think people have to take a much more responsible position than Mr. Townley, than assuming that they can. There's goodwill on the other side. I haven't seen too much of it, and I'd like to see an expression of goodwill. And I don't think that this is an expression of goodwill, building this right next to World Trade Center. Maybe, if there were a commitment to open the center to the public, if there were a revealing of the sources of funding, that might go somewhat towards alleviating my concerns.
Peter Gadiel lost his son on 9/11. He's opposed to a proposed Muslim community center to be built two blocks from Ground Zero. We also spoke with Bob Townley. He is one of 29 members of Community Board 1 in Lower Manhattan who voted in favor of the center. Peter, thank you so much.
You're very welcome.
Remember the Jewish moneylender in Shakespeare's The Merchant of Venice? Shylock lends money to Antonio under the terms that if Antonio can't pay it back, then Shylock will be entitled to a pound of his flesh. He can't be serious, right? But he is. He's tired of being picked on. Here's Al Pacino in the 2004 film.
I am a Jew! Hath not a Jew eyes? Hath not a Jew hands? Organs? Dimensions? Senses? Affections? Passions? If you prick us, do we not bleed? If you tickle us, do we not laugh? If you poison us, do we not die? And if you wrong us, shall we not revenge?
So how do you view Shylock? Paula Morant-Cohen, who's been teaching literature for 30 years, says your answer may differ over time. At least it did with her students over several decades. She recently wrote an essay in the journal The American Scholar entitled Shylock, My Students and Me. We'll connect you to it at our website, hereandnow.org. Paula Morant-Cohen is professor of English and philosophy at Drexel University in Philadelphia and joins us from her office. Professor, welcome.
Thank you.
And for those of us who don't remember the play, I'm going to have like a 60 minutes clock going in the background. Give us the 1 minute summary.
Well, it starts as a romantic story. The hero Bassanio asks his friend Antonio to lend him money so he can court the woman he loves, Portia. Antonio has his money tied up at sea, and so he seeks to borrow for his friend from the Jewish moneylender, Shylock. And Shylock agrees with the caveat that if he can't pay the money back, he will get a pound of Antonio's flesh. Antonio, as it turns out, cannot pay the money back in time, and Shylock demands his pound of flesh. In the end, Portia comes to court disguised as a man and argues against him, eventually finding a loophole that allows Antonio to get off and Shylock to be stripped of his money and forced to convert to Christianity at the end.
So there you have it, Merchant of Venice in a nutshell. And you begin your essay by talking about your students almost 30 years ago at Drexel. Now, this was a very different school. It was smaller, with largely Catholic school graduates. How did they feel about Shylock?
The students saw Shylock as the villain, the way Shakespeare's contemporaries did. He was sort of a stock villain. They had been brought up with a certain view of, I guess, the Jewish moneylender that was still present, even though the society obviously was much more advanced. They were clearly against Shylock and in favor of Bassanio and Portia.
Well, what was it then that you wanted your students to see about Shylock that you felt that maybe they weren't?
Well, Shakespeare had in mind humanizing the character to some extent. On the one hand, he was the villain in the play. On the other hand, he wants to humanize Shylock. He has that speech that you played, "Hath not a Jew hands."
Well, Shakespeare might have been trying to do that with the beginning of the speech, but you write that your students focused on the end of the speech. Now, this is where Shylock is asking, what choice does a Jew have when he wrongs a Christian? Let's listen.
If a Jew wrong a Christian, what is his humility? Revenge? If a Christian wrong a Jew, what should his sufferings be? By Christian example. Why revenge?
So, Professor, what were your students hearing there?
They were hearing the notion of Christian example, and that only through Christian example can Jews be raised up to be moral beings, in a sense.
So the students were applauding it as validation of their faith. But, of course, you could hear that as Shylock holding up a mirror to the Christian faith and showing revenge as a flaw, a villainy. But what was Shakespeare saying and having Shylock say those words?
Well, I don't know what Shakespeare would say. I think what's wonderful about the play is how it does change over time in the context of the culture in which it's read or performed, which I've found has changed drastically since then.
Let's fast forward about 15 years. Drexel is now attracting students with, you know, maybe higher SAT scores. They're more multicultural. The culture outside the school has very much changed. Even the students that you had that had gone to parochial high schools had changed. What are some of the different interpretations they now make of Shylock?
Well, I found that they tended to identify strongly with Shylock. They were very unwilling to see him as a villain. Many of them saw him as a kind of heroic figure, a victim, a marginalized individual, standing up for his rights. I think they saw a classic case of bullying in the way in which Antonio treated Shylock, and they identified with Shylock's pain. And so they were much less likely to see him as a villain, where before it was more a matter of humanizing the Jew. Now it was a question of their looking at other passages more closely and focusing on why Shylock felt so victimized, why he had reason to be as bitter and angry as he was.
Well, let's take a look at some of those. There's a scene when he's being asked to lend money to the merchant Antonio, and he spells out his resentment. Just tell us a little bit about that.
This is a scene in Act 1, Scene 3, where Shylock really spells out how he's been treated by Antonio, and the idea that this man would now turn to him for money is particularly ironic to him. Signor Antonio, many a time and oft in the Rialto you have rated me about my monies and my usances. Still have I borne it with a patient shrug, for sufferance is the badge of all our tribe. You call me misbeliever, cutthroat dog, and spat upon my Jewish gabardine, and all for use of that which is mine own. Well then, it now appears you need my help. What should I say to you? Should I not say, hath a dog money? Is it possible a cur can lend 3,000 ducats? Or shall I bend low and in a bondman's key, with bated breath and whispering humbleness, say this, fair sir, you spat on me on Wednesday last. You spurned me such a day. Another time you called me dog, and for these courtesies I'll lend you thus much money.
In other words, I was no good to you until you needed my money. What are some of the things the students said, Professor, that, you know, how did they translate that into their own lives?
Well, they felt that this was totally unfair and that Shylock had every reason not to lend to Antonio. And if he did lend to Antonio, clearly he might have an ulterior motive, and it was perfectly understandable.
But still, even though your students in modern day had more understanding of Shylock, now you have new concerns because it seems the pendulum has swung too far in his favor.
Well, I think the greatness of the play and the profundity of the play is its fundamental sense of humanity. And the fact is that if you side too entirely with Shylock, you risk becoming inhumane, because the idea of taking a pound of flesh is, of course, to kill another person who cannot pay back his debt. So when Portia gives her speech, "The quality of mercy is not strained," this speech, which my students now found to be really kind of foolish, they were less willing to listen to it than my previous students, for whom they understood the speech entirely because they had been taught, and these are my earlier students who had gone to parochial schools, that mercy, of course, is higher than justice, will always be, that human justice is flawed. But my students nowadays didn't seem to see it that way.
That's Paula Morantz-Cohen, professor of English and philosophy at Drexel University, talking about the whole new way of looking at Shakespeare's Merchant of Venice. We'll connect you to her essay in the American Scholar magazine at our website, hereandnow.org. Professor Cohen, thanks so much.
Thank you.